So Mark 15, beginning at verse 24. And they crucified him and divided his garments among them, casting lots for them to decide what each should take. And it was the third hour when they crucified him. And the inscription of the charge against him read, "The King of the Jews." And with him they crucified two robbers, one on his right and one on his left. And those who passed by derided him, wagging their heads and saying, "Aha, you who would destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself and come down from the cross." So also the chief priests with the scribes mocked him to one another, saying, "He saved others, he cannot save himself. Let the Christ, the King of Israel, come down now from the cross, that we may see and believe." Those who were crucified with him also reviled him. And when the sixth hour had come, there was darkness over the whole land until the ninth hour. And at the ninth hour, Jesus cried with a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi, lema sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" And some of the bystanders, hearing it, said, "Behold, he is calling Elijah." And someone ran and filled a sponge with sour wine and put it on a reed and gave it to him to drink, saying, "Wait, let us see whether Elijah will come and take him down." And Jesus uttered a loud cry and breathed his last. And the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. And when the centurion who stood facing him saw that in this way he breathed his last, he said, "Truly, this man was the Son of God."
Well, what is so good about Good Friday? I mean, apart from the day off work, hopefully, the festivities, the hot cross buns, which are a favourite in my household year round, why do they call the day itself good? How could the death of Jesus on a cross, which those buns point to, be a good thing? To many, the cross seems tragic, the waste of an aspiring young leader. To many, it seems irrelevant. 2,000 years ago, what good could it be to us today? To many, the cross seems barbaric. Crucifixion was a horrible way to die. And for sure, on the surface, Mark's account of the cross, which we just heard, is painful to read. But dig a little deeper, and Mark shows us that Jesus' death is actually the most wonderful thing in all of human history. To see that, we're going to focus on verses 33 to 39 of Mark 15 to reflect on the two cries of Jesus as he hangs on the cross. The first, a cry of suffering. The second, a cry of death. And through the pain and the sorrow, I hope that we'll see how that first Good Friday 2,000 years ago really was good. So first, you'll see on the handout on the reverse of the sheet, Jesus suffers facing God's judgment. God's judgment is what is signified by the darkness in verse 33, if you have a look down there. When the sixth hour had come, there was darkness over the whole land until the ninth hour. Now, I don't know if you've ever seen an eclipse. I remember lots of hype about the so-called total eclipse of 1999 in the UK. I was on holiday with my family and some guy had flogged us those flimsy little eclipse glasses. And we were all out waiting for the moment when the sun was supposed to be blocked out for a few minutes. I don't know if you remember this and you had the same experience, but for me, it was a massive anticlimax. I don't really remember anything of note changing at all. It turns out a few clouds were enough to basically obscure it. Well, that is very different from what is going on here in this account. What we've just read about is a supernatural event. There was a proper darkness over the whole land that lasted for 3 hours. From the sixth hour, that's 12 noon, to 3 p.m., normally the brightest time of the day. I mean, how can you imagine how eerie that would have been? If it were today, we would be in pitch darkness right now. Suddenly, the sun with its heat just disappears, and we're left in this sort of cold, chilling darkness. And it was a foretaste that day of Judgment Day. A couple of chapters earlier in Mark's Gospel, Jesus speaks of the final judgment as a day when the sun will be darkened as God rightly punishes wrongdoing. Well, here was a preview of that final day. Part of God's judgment was being visibly poured out in advance. And on who? Well, remarkably, on Jesus. Jesus is facing God's wrath. We see that in verse 34. It's directed at him. At the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi, lema sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" See, Jesus was experiencing being forsaken by his Father. He was bearing the full force of God's holy displeasure. And this is really shocking. It's shocking because two things are repeatedly stressed in chapter 15, in the verses just before this account. Jesus is innocent, and Jesus is God's king. Jesus is innocent. His enemies had accused him again and again, but they had failed to convict him of any wrongdoing. Pilate gets exasperated with them, says, "Why? What evil has he done?" Jesus is innocent, but also Jesus is God's king. His claim to be the king was the only thing that they could charge him with in the end. And the irony builds throughout the chapter as the soldiers give him this crown of thorns and kneel before him, mocking, "Hail, King of the Jews." Even the inscription above his cross reads, "The King of the Jews." So on one hand, this is so shocking. God's innocent king is the one suffering. And yet, on the other hand, it shouldn't be that shocking because all of this had been planned out beforehand. Jesus himself had predicted three times his arrest, his suffering, his crucifixion. And now, as he cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me?" he is also actually quoting from the Old Testament, from Psalm 22. It's a song written by the Old Testament's greatest king, King David. Because what Jesus is doing here is also reminding us that suffering is actually a confirming hallmark of God's true king. I'll read a few verses from Psalm 22 and just notice how King David's suffering foreshadows even the smallest details of what's happening to his descendant Jesus here. Psalm 22, "All my bones are out of joint. My strength is dried up. My tongue sticks to my jaws. You lay me in the dust of death. For a company of evildoers encircles me. They have pierced my hands and feet. They stare and gloat over me. They divide my garments among them. And for my clothing, they cast lots." You see, the cross was always the plan for God's true king. There is no mistake here or tragedy. This royal pattern had been laid out long ago by David. This is what makes Jesus truly kingly in God's eyes. God's true king had to suffer in this way. But if this was all part of God's plan, well, what is the purpose of it? What is the purpose of all this suffering? And that brings us to the next sub-point. Jesus was facing God's judgment in place of others. Jesus explained this back in chapter 10 of Mark as he described his mission. He said that he came to give his life as a ransom for many. His life would be the ransom price given in place of others' freedom, spiritually speaking. And the stress on Jesus' innocence in this chapter reminds us of this, that he is clearly not suffering for any sin of his own. He must be paying this ransom in place of others. Salvo D'Acquisto was a young Italian policeman during World War II, and by 1943, the Nazis had taken control of his hometown. Well, one morning, Salvo saw a group of feared SS soldiers approaching, and a Nazi officer came straight up to Salvo accusing his village of a nearby explosion which had killed a Nazi soldier. This officer was furious, and he rounded up all the villagers he could find, 22 villagers, and told Salvo, if you can't find the person responsible, they will all be shot. Well, no one came forward. And so the villagers were forced to dig their own mass grave. But seeing the judgment was about to fall, Salvo stepped forward and spoke up. Even though he was actually totally innocent, he took the blame, saying that he had caused that explosion and had acted completely alone. He stressed that the others should be let go. See, those villagers had this sentence hanging over them, but Salvo redirected it onto himself. He acted as a substitute and faced the firing squad alone. He took the punishment in their place to save them. And that is what Jesus did as he hung in the darkness. He was redirecting the sentence that hangs over sinful people like you and me onto himself. Even though he was totally innocent, Jesus willingly faced God's judgment in place of others. And there are hints of this substitution if you read the rest of this chapter. We are told of Barabbas. You may know the story, the guilty criminal whose life sentence is inexplicably redirected onto Jesus. I mean, imagine how Barabbas would have felt sitting in the prison when he heard that he was being set free instead of Jesus. And imagine him watching just a few hours later as Jesus hung on the cross. Can imagine him thinking that it should have been him there, but that Jesus had taken his place. And it is not just Barabbas. None of us have lived as we should. We've all failed God's good and perfect standards. Every person, the Bible says, is actually guilty before God. But Jesus, though innocent, takes the punishment for the guilty. Jesus is the only one without a guilty sentence himself. So only Jesus can take our place. And remarkably, wonderfully, he is willing to do it. Even as he's taunted on the cross, save yourself. He saved others. He cannot save himself. Well, the irony is, Jesus could have saved himself, but he refused. He wouldn't save himself, precisely because he was determined to save others. And so Jesus stayed on that cross, and he faced God's judgment. He suffered. And if you're a Christian, you have the privilege of saying that he did that for you. As the song goes, it was my sin that held him there until it was accomplished. His dying breath has brought me life. I know that it is finished. The tragedy is that so few people really understand what was going on the cross. As Jesus cried, Eloi, Eloi, lema sabachthani, my God, why have you forsaken me? He's surrounded by misunderstanding. Bystanders seem to mishear Eloi for Eli and think that he's calling Elijah, the prophet, to rescue him. You see, to most people there that day, this once popular religious figure had become a needy, pitiable figure on his way out. And that is what we can really expect from the world around us today as well. Most of our friends, our colleagues, don't see Jesus for who he really is. They think of him as just a pitiable figure who is now well and truly on his way out. But that means that they are actually the ones who are needy and pitiable. They are facing God's sentence of judgment, and yet they don't even know it. But Jesus had compassion on people who are lost like that. Just before he fed the 5,000, we read that Jesus saw a great crowd and he had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. See, Jesus came for people who didn't even know that they were in danger, like sheep without a shepherd. He wants to take the place of people like that. And that brings us to our next point, Jesus' second cry, as Jesus dies, opening salvation. The second cry that Mark tells us about is striking because crucifixion was designed to exhaust its victims until they could no longer pull themselves up to breathe and quietly slipped into a sort of unconscious suffocation. But in verse 37, Jesus is able to utter a loud cry as he breathes his last. It seems to be another reminder that Jesus is no passive victim here. Rather, he is actively at work, even as he dies. That he's there on his own terms, achieving salvation, keeping his word just as he'd promised. And it is this moment of his death where this judgment-bearing, ransoming work is completed, and he truly opens the way to salvation. And Mark shows us this with a sudden scene change in verse 38. If his account were a movie, the camera would have had to pan away. It had been outside Jerusalem, that's where Jesus was on the cross, but it goes, just for one verse, to the city centre, to the temple. And the camera zooms inside to the enormous curtain of the innermost holy place where God's presence symbolically dwelt. That is why people went to the temple. It was the way to approach God and to make sacrifices for forgiveness. But now Jesus dies as the perfect sacrifice. And so God does away with the old temple system. Have another look at verse 38, if you would. The curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. See, any in the temple that afternoon would have heard an almighty shredding sound as God literally ripped up the holy place. It was a huge sign that the temple system was now redundant and that God had left the building. That phrase was announced at the end of Elvis concerts to try and get rid of the crowds, hopeful for an encore. Elvis has left the building. It's meant to say that there's no point hanging around because you won't find Elvis there anymore. And similarly, this ripped curtain means that there's no point hanging around in the temple because we won't find God there anymore. See, the temple served a makeshift, temporary, limited purpose, but now it has been replaced with Jesus' death. That is the real and better way to relate to God now. It has opened up the possibility of forgiveness and relationship with God wherever we are and whoever we are. Which brings us to our final sub-point. Salvation is open to any who believe. I don't know if you've seen on Netflix, The English Games, a series about the game of football in the 19th century opening up to the masses. Originally, it was only played by the most privileged schools in England, and the aristocracy thought of football as their game. But despite resistance from the elite, increasingly the door was forced open for everyone else, and the hardened mining towns take on the posh toffs in sort of quite amusing little confrontations. And of course, football today is enjoyed in every country of the world, no matter what class or background people are from, no matter if you've got a full-size pitch or just a tiny scrap of ground somewhere. I mean, many of the best players started off in backyards or council estates, on streets and the slums of the world's poorest nations. Football is now open to anyone, and it is much better for it. And in a similar but far more important way, how wonderful it is that salvation is now open to anyone, anywhere. Meeting with God, relating to him, approaching God is no longer a privilege just for a few. God doesn't hang around in special buildings anymore. There is nothing holy now about going to Jerusalem or the Vatican, for example. Sure, it may be interesting, but it won't get us any closer to God than if we were to pray at home or at your office, at work. See, Jesus' death has opened up the privilege of approaching God to anyone, wherever and whoever they are. And the centurion overseeing Jesus' crucifixion makes this point. He wasn't Jewish, he was a Roman. He was considered an enemy of God's people. And to become a centurion, well, he must have been very good at killing people, I imagine. So a very unlikely person to be accepted by God. And yet it seems that he is the first to be saved after Jesus' death. Salvation is open to anyone. But that doesn't mean that it is found by everyone. We've considered how it seems there is real hope for the lost crowds, despite their current ignorance. But there does seem to be less hope for the religious leaders of Jesus' day. Throughout the whole gospel, they had been bent against Jesus, trying to just get rid of him. And their cruel mocking at his death seems just to confirm their rejection of him. Well, Jesus was clear in his teaching that those who reject him will be rejected by God. Salvation can't be for them. See, a right response to Jesus is necessary. And so what is it about the centurion's response that is right? Well, have a look at verse 39, our final verse. When the centurion, who stood facing Jesus, saw that in this way he breathed his last, he said, "Truly, this man was the Son of God." On one hand, we could say it's as simple as believing in Jesus. He makes this great declaration of faith. Truly, this man was the Son of God. But to call Jesus the Son of God is a hugely loaded and significant phrase. It is how Mark introduces us to Jesus in the very first sentence, the very first line of his whole gospel, back in chapter 1. Jesus Christ, the Son of God. It's a title of utter authority. It basically means that Jesus is God's king, and everyone needs to get on the right side of him. But throughout the gospel, actually no human in Mark's gospel has acknowledged Jesus as the Son until this moment. This is the moment that Mark has been trying to get his readers to. It's here with the centurion that we're supposed to think, bingo, finally. This centurion has had his eyes opened to see Jesus for who he really is. But the strange thing is that this eureka moment happens as Jesus dies. He sees Jesus as the king as he dies. I mean, most people saw the cross as weakness and failure. The religious leaders mocked, "Come down now from the cross that we may see and believe." But ironically, it's as Jesus doesn't come down from the cross that this centurion sees and believes. He looks at the cross and sees Jesus' divine authority. "Truly," he says, "this man was the Son of God." He acknowledges Jesus as God's king, even as he dies, or more precisely, because Jesus died. And that is what Mark wants us as his readers to see too. It is at the cross, as Jesus suffers God's judgment in our place and dies, that he is truly shown to be king. Jesus' willingness to lower himself at the cross is what best shows his exalted authority as king. His embracing weakness at the cross is what shows his strength as king. His laying down of his rights is what shows his right to be our king. And so as we draw towards a close, I'd encourage us to keep reflecting on the cross this Easter time. If this is somewhat new to you, I hope that you can see what is so good about this first Good Friday. Jesus' death opens up the way of salvation to anyone. It is open to you if you're willing to put your trust in his death and make Jesus your king. And for those of us who are already followers of Jesus, I hope this renews our praise and wonder at all that Jesus has done for us, particularly maybe if we're feeling just a little bit dry, a bit tired, a bit stagnant in our faith perhaps. The cross is the only source of real living faith. And I hope it encourages us to live with Jesus as King in every area of our lives, to give him the reins of our ambitions, our careers, our time, our reputations. That may at times feel like that is leading us down our own path of suffering, as others think we are weird and so on for following Jesus publicly. But as we look to Jesus' sacrifice, we are reminded that it is worth sacrificing anything for him, for all that he has done for us. Well, why don't I pray to close our time? Father, thank you so much that Jesus willingly suffered and died to save sinful people like us. Thank you that if we're following Jesus as our King, we can know that he faced the judgment that we deserve in our place. Thank you so much that salvation is now open to anyone. And please help us to consider how to live in light of this. Amen.